Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
Hello there, my friend. Douglas B. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. This is Mr. Constitution Hour, and we hear all the time people on both sides of the aisle say this. We have Democrats, we have Republicans, we have conservatives, we have liberals, progressives, everybody seems to say, well, Doug, the system is broken. They're right, the system is broken. From a constitutional standpoint, it's very broken. And I'm going to talk a little bit about, because we had left off in our lessons on the Constitution in Article 1. We had gone through Sections 2 and 3, but I want to get back into a general discussion about what Article 1, Section 1, 2, and 3 mean. Article 1, Section 1, Article 1, Section 2, Article 1, Section 3. These are the sections that create our Congress. The two houses of Congress, our House of Representatives and our Senate. A little over a year ago, I published a book called Repeal Democracy. And people are shocked by the title, Repeal Democracy. Doug, you want to get rid of democracy? Well, pure democracy, yes. Originally in our system, according to the Constitution, there was only one Democratic vote at the federal level, purely Democratic, and that was the House of Representatives. This is not to say that the people's voice is not important. The people's voice is very important. But what the founders understood was pure democracy. Whenever you allow for too much power in one place, including too much power in the vote of the people's hands, if you have too much power in one place, it creates a problem. It creates tyranny. So even a pure democracy, too much power in the vote of the people is dangerous. So they created a republic. And a republic, part of the primary part of or definition of what a republic is a mixed system. It's a mixed constitution with checks and balances. So in other words, all of the power is not in one place. There are multiple constituencies, for example, when it comes to the United States Congress. We have what is called a bicameral Congress, bicameral two chambers. And they created two chambers on purpose. Prior to the Constitution, we operated under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation had a single house. A Confederation Congress, or Congress of the Confederation. Prior to that, under the Declaration of Independence, which we really didn't have a system set up yet. Articles of Confederation and Constitution were not around yet. We were a country. Declaration of Independence declared our independence, but all we had was the Continental Congress, which was basically originally just an underground rebel Congress against the British Empire. And it was one house, just like the one under the Articles of Confederation. And the one house with each state having one vote. The states could have, you know, between 7 to 12 delegates, or 7 to 14, something like that, delegates, but each state only had one vote. They wanted the voice of the states to be equal. So when it came to the Constitution, there was a discussion regarding that, Virginia plan versus the New Jersey plan. You have James Madison showing up at the convention with this Virginia plan that basically what it did is it pushed proportional representation, meaning that a state's voice would be dependent upon its population. So the larger states, population-wise, would have a greater voice in the Congress than the other states, the smaller states. And smaller states didn't like that idea because they liked the idea that their voice was strong enough to be equal with the other states so that they wouldn't be dominated by the other states. So there was a discussion between the larger states and smaller states, Virginia plan versus the New Jersey plan, and what developed was a brilliant system because in a republic, you do want the voice of the people to be important, but you also need to make sure that the constituency of the state's voices are important. They are, after all, the entities who sent delegates or deputies, as some of the states call them, to the Constitutional Convention to write this Constitution. So, you know, they need to have a voice as well. Plus, also, you don't want to have too much democracy. You got to mix the system up. You want the two houses of Congress to be different. And that's what eventually happened with the Connecticut Compromise, is the House of Representatives basically stayed with the proportional representation, and the Senate went with the even representation, two per state. And that made the smaller states happy, but the larger states are happy because you have the House. But also what was important, and this is something that George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Madison all discussed later, was the importance of the houses being different from each other. They're unique. One carried out certain functions and was expected to act in a certain way. The others carried out different functions and was expected to act in a different way. So, you know, because when you have democracy, what happens is the population centers, the cities, have a bigger voice because that's where the most people are. And so the larger population, the mob, tends to have a little bit more control when there's a democracy. House of Representatives, day one, has always been voted in democratically. So you've got districts set up by population, and then the population directly votes in their representatives. The states who have the largest populations have the biggest voice, and their voice is based on the constituency voting them in. So the people's voice is important to them. They're going to try to listen to them. And the people, being uninformed typically, or not very informed, or having their own pet projects, their own preferences, they like government programs and things like that, they are going to expect their members of the House to vote in that manner. But when it came to the U.S. Senate, which was originally intended to be, they were appointed by the state legislatures, and the state legislatures also were different back then. They weren't all democratically voted in. The State House of Representatives, State Assembly, whatever you want to call it, State House of Delegates, I think is what some states call it, that has always been democratically voted in, but the state Senate was not, just like the government model there at the federal system. So those senators were appointed by the county legislatures, and it was one per county. That way the counties had an equal voice. So the cities had a voice in the state House of Representatives, the state assemblies, or whatever you want to call them, and in the state Senate, it was more the voice of the counties. Now, when you look at a state and you look at the counties, you ever looked at the election at the county level? All the states are dominantly red or Republican, conservative, because they are rural. Most of the counties are rural areas. Rural areas, people who are farmers and, you know, work in the agrarian industries and so on and so forth, they have a different way of looking at things than the people from the cities. They don't want so many government programs. They want to be left alone. They want to take care of their farm without interference and take care of their business and do the things they... So it's a whole different attitude. And the Founding Fathers recognized that the cities and the rural areas had different attitudes. And back then, some of the rural areas also were high slavery areas, and that's a whole different discussion for a different time. But the idea was you have city populations who want government programs and government interference, and you have rural areas that want as little government interference as possible, laissez-faire, leave things to their own devices. And so what that does is that creates in the Congress, then, because your state Senate is going to lean rural, your state houses of representatives are going to lean towards the states. In most states, not all of them, some of them they might lean rural. But in the long run, the House of Representatives is going to tend to lean towards city thinking, and the U.S. Senate is going to tend to lean towards rural thinking also. So because that, and that's where the states are set up, because the states, remember, state legislatures are choosing the senators also. So you're going to have one house choosing state House of Representatives choosing one senator, the state Senate choosing the other senator. Pretty much all the state senates are probably going to be very rural. They're going to pick a rural-minded U.S. senator. The state House of Representatives is going to be mixed. Some of them are going to be heavily dominated by the cities. In more rural states, not so much. So your U.S. Senate is going to be more rurally minded. But the House of Representatives, because the cities have the most districts, you're going to wind up with a House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, that's city-minded and leaning towards bigger government and programs. So what this did is that gave us a republic, not democracy, because there's a different way of putting people in there, so that we have a mixed system, a mixed constituency, so that one side doesn't dominate over the other. The founding fathers looked back in history, and what they saw was that politics is about domination. Politics is about who gets control and which faction is controlling things. If you read the transcripts from the Declaration of Independence, you know, Constitutional Convention, the early meetings, it was all about, well, gosh, this state is controlled by that faction, and this state is controlled by this faction. And they were worried about the factions controlling things. And there weren't political parties yet, but the factions did exist. And the attitude was, the best way to control the factions is not to let them run wild. The best way to control the factions is to pit them against each other. Have them so busy with each other, dealing with each other, that one cannot control the other. So you make sure that the rural faction has a bigger voice in the U.S. Senate. You make sure, and then you give the House of Representatives to the city factions, and there you have big government and little government fighting, and you get some type of compromise in between. And that's what was designed, that our bicameral Congress, two houses that are different from each other, looking at things from a different point of view, not only to ensure that the best, most necessary laws only get passed, but also because that keeps one faction from dominating, because they're battling each other. That was the original system. So yes, our system is broken. Of course, our system is broken because we've stopped being a republic. Democracy is our problem. And that is the reason why my latest book is called Repeal Democracy. We need to repeal what's killing us here. And what's killing us is democracy, pure democracy. We've got a political class that is sitting there, oh, we got to save our democracy. And I don't want to save our democracy. I want it not to be a democracy. I don't want it to be a pure democracy, and neither did the founding fathers. John Adams said that there was never been a democracy that didn't commit suicide. And Madison said that Madisons are short in their lives and violent in their deaths. Democracy is the problem. That does not mean that you take the extreme of eliminating democracy completely. It is smart to have our House of Representatives democratically voted in, our state House of Representatives democratically voted in. That's a good thing. But you don't want also your Senate democratically voted in, because then you've got two houses that are no different from each other, and they're democratically put in there, which means the cities have the biggest influence. Even when it comes to Republicans, they're city-minded, they're program-minded. Because cities, city populations, like government programs, like to do things through government programs, which, you know, some might call progressive. Well, you know, Jefferson believed in laissez-faire, letting things take their own course, keeping government out as much as we can, only making necessary laws. We want that thinking in there too. We want them to balance each other out. We understand that there might be need for the occasional government regulation or something on something, because otherwise, if you have complete anarchy, things run amok. So you want government involved in certain things in certain ways. The federal government has certain authorities, things that they're allowed to take care of. States can have certain authorities, things they can take care of. Otherwise, leave everybody alone. But you don't want the extremes. You want too much government because you have tyranny. If you don't have enough government, then you have, you know, tyranny among the population. You lose your freedom because you can't go to work, because you can't leave your house because people might steal it, because there is no law enforcement. And so you're on the front porch with your rifle protecting your things. That's what happens in, you know, an anarchy. So, you know, you don't want the extremes. And that was the plan here, is to avoid the extremes. Now, I lean towards limited government. I lean towards government having as little domestic influence as possible, because that's the way it was designed. But that is not to mean that it should have none. And the problem is, we live in a world that's extreme. Either you believe this or you believe that. Well, if you don't embrace something, then you must hate it. And if you hate something, you must embrace it. There is no in-between, and usually that's where the answer is. It's somewhere in the middle, not at the extreme ends. Now, the thing is, the fringe left has gone so far to the fringe that anything to the right of them, they consider fringe. I don't like using right-left because even that doesn't really truly purely exist. Where that comes from in France, before the French Revolution, those who wanted no change and agreed with the king and agreed with the state church, and they were believed in, you know, the religious establishment and believed that the king was the head of the church and all of that, that they sat on the right side of the auditorium. Those who wanted a secular system, more collective system, to get rid of the king, get rid of the established religion, they wanted change, those people sat on the left. That's where our modern kind of sort of idea of right-left came from. But in the United States, there was never a king, there was never an established church. So the right-left sphere, political spectrum didn't develop the same way. It developed in a different way. To the left is 100% government, to the right is zero government. So far right is anarchy. To the right of the middle would be things like democracy. Anarchy and democracy both always become ultimately an oligarchy, a powerful few ruling over the many, which is far left. Far left would be oligarchy and monarchy and dictatorships and potentates and communism and socialism and even fascism. Even though they say it's to the far right, it's not. It's to the left. Fascism is, you know, government controlling things, so it's on the far left. So this idea that that's to the far right, fascism, Nazis were far right, that's absolutely ridiculous. There's nothing that can define it to the far right. Ask next time you hear someone say, well, you know those neo-Nazi far right, extreme right. Well, what does that mean? Right. Well, define your terms. They can't. The definition of the terms is how much government is in play. That fascism is no different than communism except for how it is applied. So in other words, communism, and really communism's never been totally achieved. Communism would be the utopian society, and so communism would be socialism realized, and it never has been. So let's drop communism and call it socialism. That's what it really is. Socialism is the animal trying to get it to communism. Communism's not possible because human nature would never allow it. But anyway, so under socialism, government controls the means of production by owning it. Government controls the means of production by owning it. Everything gets nationalized. You saw that in Venezuela, right? They were one of the most prosperous countries in South America, and they had these private oil companies, and then they nationalized it, where the government controlled it, they controlled the means of production, and then everything went to heck. But anyway, so socialism is government control of the means of production through ownership. Fascism is government control of the means of production through heavy regulation. It's the same thing done differently. So how is it to the right? Fascism, Nazism, all of that is to the left. It's big government. It is controlling the means of production just like socialism does. No different, just except for how it's done. That's the only difference. So anyway, so you've got this right-left paradigm that's going on, and you got the Founding Fathers creating this Constitution. The Constitution doesn't go right and left. Constitution is dead center. Constitution is dead center. Takes the idea of a big government, but limits the heck out of it. It's dead center. Democracy and anarchy's to the right, but they always become far left oligarchy. Everything to the left of the Constitution, any government bigger than the Constitution is to the left of the Constitution. Well, then everything's to the left of the Constitution. Even the Republican Party is to the left of the Constitution. So there really isn't a right wing. The Republicans and the alleged right wing is to the right of the left. It's to the right of the, you know, the progressive, liberal, socialist, you know who's. But it's still to the left of the Constitution. It's to the right of the left, but it's to the left of the Constitution. So there is no right wing. Because the moment there is a right wing, pure democracy and anarchy, it becomes the left, oligarchy. So if there is a right wing, it doesn't last long. So you have the Constitution, and you have everything to the left of it. So you'll hear me call the left, left-wing, whatever, but you'll rarely hear me say to the right or right-wing. And when I do, it's not because I'm doing the right-wing, left-wing thing, but I'm talking about things to the right of the left. I'm talking about, you know, also how they sit, because believe it or not, they even do the right-left thing in our own legislature. So that's what I'm talking about. So now we get back to our Congress. Typically, historically, your U.S. Senate is going to lean closer to the Constitution, rural, laissez-faire, leave-me-alone type attitude, and your House of Representatives is going to lean leftward a little bit, because they're going to be the ones that want to create programs. And it's okay a little bit. You know, Doug, you know, so you are, you know, this great white conservative, so you must hate then the safety net. Well, then what happens if someone needs help? I never said that I hate the safety net. I just don't believe it should be used or utilized the way it is. And I don't believe it's the federal government's business. The federal government has no authority to create a safety net, but the states do. So if the states want to have a safety net, great. If a state doesn't, they don't. If you don't like it, move to a state that agrees with you. Should there be a safety net? Should there be health care, for example, for someone who can't afford health insurance and suddenly they find themselves in a tough situation, they got to go to the doctor and they can't afford it, and so there's some state program there? Sure, by the state, not by the federal government. So, see, but people who disagree with me politically, they automatically assume, since they believe there must be a program like that, that the government must always be there to help someone no matter what, then anyone who doesn't agree 100% with them must believe the opposite. Therefore, if I don't believe that the federal government safety net is constitutional, well, then I must think that there should be no safety net. And I never said that. But see, people don't shut up and listen long enough to know that. They just make their assumptions. See, they get a little bit of information. They've already decided they hate those who are against them. They make their assumptions. They decide what the other side's thinking, and usually it's wrong. You know, you just don't assume. There is more to what is believed than what people are realizing. So, it's not a matter of whether or not there should be a safety net, or there should be government programs, or there should be government involvement. It is the degree in which that should exist, and who has the authority to create it or have it. Federal government doesn't have any authority. Constitution does give the federal government authority over health care or programs to help people or whatever. But the states can if they want. And if a state wants to have a big, giant program, fine. If they want to have a small program, fine. If they want to have no program, their choice. If you don't like it, move to a state that agrees with you and then utilize their programs. It's up to the states. And it always has been. But now, like I said, we've got a political battle going on right now that is basically chosen sides. And they've gone far left, far socialist, far programs for everyone. You know, and if you disagree, then you must be the opposite extreme. And it goes with other things too. Immigration, for example. You know, and we talk about immigration, and we've got the left now with this wide open border and let anybody cross, no matter who they are, where they come from, and all that. And if you disagree with them, then you must hate immigration. I don't know anybody that hates immigration. This country was built on immigration. I have no problem with people wanting to come to this country. Immigrate. Great. But it shouldn't be a wide open door with a flood of people coming across and we're not checking who it is. I mean, you've got a front door at your house. You don't just throw the door open and let anybody in, do you? No, you expect people to knock. And then even before you get to talking to them or open the door, you ask, who is it? You look through the little peephole. You find out you vet them before you allow them to even have a conversation with you, much less come in your house. That's the border. That's the way it's supposed to operate. You want to come to this country? Great, but go through the process. Knock on the door, talk to the Border Patrol or to ICE or to the whatever program is in place. Go through the paperwork, go through the vetting process. And then if we like what we hear, we don't believe you're a criminal, we don't believe you're MI-13, come on in. But if not, you're not coming in. If you're from a country that hates us and wants to destroy us, like China or Iran, you're not coming in. Well, what if they're a refugee, Doug? Well, then that needs to be determined on a case-by-case basis. Give them the chance. Maybe they can prove to us that there's a certain allegiance and they're willing to assimilate. Otherwise, you can't come in. That's not being cold. That's not being cold-hearted and mean. That's protecting your country from elements that are not good for it, just like at your front door. You lock your door because you don't want outside elements that are not good for your household in your front door. Just like with immigration, no different. The border is our front door. Ring the doorbell, knock, let us vet you before we let you in. And if we don't think that you're good for our household, we're not letting you in. That is proper immigration policy. But the problem is, the left is so good at marketing, if you disagree with their open board crazy policies, then you must hate immigration, you're racist, and you don't, and you hate Mexicans, or you hate blacks, or you hate Asians, or whatever, you know, and they come up with all their stupid stuff. And that's because that's what they do. And then there, you got all these pawns out there, these tools that believe this stuff. And they follow it, and they get all convinced, oh, no, those people are a bunch of racists. Really? I've gone over this ad nauseum, but it needs to be brought up again. It's like, for example, January 6th. Oh, well, if you support what happened there, then you're an insurrectionist, you love violence. No, that's not true. Well, then why would you support such a thing? I never said I supported it. I just don't think the way you do, thinking that it was an insurrection. It wasn't. First of all, there is evidence abound, evidence around us, all kinds of evidence, that first of all, just look at the timeline, the breach of the barriers happened at 1 o'clock on that day. Trump didn't even finish speaking until 1:10. So the violence, the alleged violence on January 6th began before Trump was even done talking. And where he was talking was a minimum 20-minute walk away, and that's if you don't have people in the way, you're not stopping to go to the bathroom and stopping to get food and checking into your hotel room or something like that. And so who were the people then that were there breaching the barriers? They weren't people that had been listening to Trump, because Trump wasn't even done talking yet. So they were somebody else. Logic. Well, if they were somebody else, then who were they? Well, evidence is showing that the majority of the people that were there before the people who listened to Trump got there were FBI plants, Antifa, and BLM. Is it possible that there were some MAGA Republicans, Trump supporters, mixed into that early crowd that got rowdy? Sure, I guess it's possible. And there is a handful of people that have been identified as such. But think about it. Just think about the normal mindset of Trump supporters, Republicans, conservatives. Are they typically violent? No. Tea parties don't, you know, blow up and start burning cities down like BLM and Antifa did in Baltimore and Ferguson and Seattle and Portland. They tend to be peaceful. Why? Because most MAGA Republicans are my age and older. We don't play that stupid violent game. And who were the violent people at the Capitol on January 6th? Younger people who were wearing their MAGA hats backwards. I've got a poster from 2019, 2 years before that happened, from Antifa. It says, hey, go to Trump rallies, wear a MAGA hat backwards so we can identify each other, and let's pretend we're MAGA people and cause problems so that the news thinks that MAGA people are violent. I've got the poster from 2 years before it even happened on January 6th. That's the game they play. These people were plants for the most part. First of all, so the breach of the barrier 10 minutes before Trump's even done talking. Trump finishes talking, and rather than the normal 20-minute walk it would take, most of them is taking them 45 minutes to an hour. Why? There's millions of people, or thousands if you listen to the left. And a lot of those people, after listening to Trump, they don't just walk to the Capitol. Some of them go to their hotel room. Some of them still need to check in. Some of them want to grab some lunch. Some of them need to grab some water or something. Some of them need to go to the toilet. So they're not there in 20 minutes. They're there in 30, 40, 45 minutes, 60 minutes later. After the violence is over. They show up. They're confused. What happened here? Why are the cops all going crazy? Look, the doors of the Capitol is open and there's people going in and out. So it's almost like a tour visit. They're going, yeah, you've seen the video. They're walking through the Capitol inside the velvet ropes, looking back and forth at the different things. Like a tour guide is leading them through the Capitol. No violence. Why? The violence was caused by the plants. The MAGA Republicans didn't cause the violence. By the time they got there, the violence was over. And yet these people, their lives are being destroyed because they dared to show up. My friend Derek Kinnison, who's been on my radio shows, showed up 45 minutes after the quote-unquote insurrection riot happened, prayed with some people. There's video of him with his arms around his friends, praying, shook some hands, never confronted a Capitol police officer, never stepped on any concrete. It was on the grass area on the west side. Never went into the building, and he's awaiting sentencing. Prosecution originally was pushing for 27 years of federal prison. He was found guilty on all counts, and most of them, they're impossible. One of them is disrupting an official meeting. He got there after the meeting broke up. How did he interfere with the meeting? For example. But because we have a system now that's broken, that has decided he's automatically guilty because he was there, and there's no evidence. The evidence is a video of him praying and a photograph of him. And that's it. There's no witnesses saying, yeah, he did this. And there's no video evidence going, oh, look, he's doing that. There's a photograph of his face with a hat on that has an anti-Antifa logo on it. And a video of him praying with his three friends. Four of them with their arms around each other. Looks like a huddle. That's it. That's all the evidence. There's no other evidence for anything. And he was found guilty on all counts. And in April, they're going to sentence him. And he's looking at somewhere between 3 and 15 years of federal prison. Originally, they were pushing 27 years of federal prison. The maximum got dropped to 15. So think about this. This guy's looking at minimum, bare bones minimum, 3 years federal prison for showing up, praying, shaking hands, and leaving after all the hubbub happened. And now we have a Biden administration saying we're going to hunt down anybody and everybody associated with it, even if they weren't there. And, well, I'm talking about it. Am I now going to be hunted down for this? Because I talked about it? What type of dictatorial, totalitarian garbage is this? I thought we had freedom of speech. I thought we had freedom of religion. I thought we had freedom of the press. I thought we had freedom of assembly. I thought we had the freedom to petition our government for redress of grievances. Those are the five rights enumerated in the First Amendment. The same five that all of the January 6th people were practicing, carrying out. But yet they're guilty? For what? Disagreeing with the government? Well, Doug, the violence, the insurrection. Wait a second. Insurrection is to overthrow the government. So you're trying to tell me that a bunch of conservatives who believe in the Second Amendment went there to cause an insurrection, overthrow the government, but not a single one of them had a gun? There was not a single gun confiscated. Not one. Not one knife confiscated. Not one gun, not one violent act other than some broken glass and most of the stuff caused by the Capitol Police and the plants that were there before the Trump people showed up. But because I believe what I believe and because most people won't look into all those facts, I agree with violence and insurrection and I'm a right-wing domestic terrorist. Really? But anyway, so when that gets back to now, well, is our system broken? Yes. So now we have Congress, based on democracy, deciding that they're not there to serve the people. They're not there to abide by the Bill of Rights. They're there to be rulers. And if you dare speak out against them, it's insurrection, and they're going to arrest you and throw you in federal prison. And you have Americans going, yeah, yeah, because those people were violent. Really? Were you there? Where's the evidence? Well, I saw the video. You saw the video they showed you was the people before the Trump people got there. And they were very careful on what video they showed. When they released all the other video, and you saw it on Tucker Carlson and a few other places, it's all peaceful. Why? Because the MAGA Republicans, the Trump supporters, the conservatives, the GOPers were peaceful. They showed up, they walked through, they shook hands, they talked to each other, and they left. But because the plants that were there ahead of time acted in a violent manner, that now, I'll give you another example. There's this gun thing. You know, we got a couple of shootings the last couple weeks, right? So we have the shooting at Joel Osteen's church, which turned out to be a transsexual lefty. And we got the shooting at the Kansas City Chiefs parade. And at last time I've looked at the evidence on that, we haven't determined if the shooter was, you know, a right winger, left winger, or in betweener. And I know I don't say right winger, but you know what I mean. Here's the thing. They, and when I say they, I mean the left, the Democrats, the progressives, have been trying to peg their opposition as being violent during my whole life. They were doing this back during Reagan. And they say that all these shootings, these mass shootings, dangerous guns, is evidence of the dangerous right wing out there. Here's the problem. Every single one, not some of, not most of, every single one of the shooters in every single mass shooting to date has been by a left-wing progressive Democrat. All of them. Look, even the young shooters, their parents were left-wing. All of them. Not a single conservative, militia-believing, Second Amendment-believing person was behind any of those shootings. Not one. I was talking to the Riverside County Sheriff a couple weeks ago, and he was telling me that, or he told a crowd, actually, but he told me too later, that before he became sheriff, it was taking a couple of years to get your concealed carry. And the left will sit there and say, well, all these concealed carries are dangerous because these people, you know, are violent because of the shootings. So he broke out all the records. Guess how many people with a concealed carry permit in Riverside County, since they've been taking records for decades and decades and decades and decades, how many of them have been involved in mass shootings? The answer is zero. How many of their guns have been involved in mass shootings? In other words, someone got a hold of their guns. Zero. Every single gun, every single shooting has been by left-wing Democrats. All of them. Or people even further left than Democrats. Socialists, communists, so on and so forth. Not a single shooting by a law-abiding gun owner who has gotten a concealed carry permit in California, much less Riverside County. The guns are not the problem. Left-wingers with guns is the problem. And if guns were the problem, and if right-wingers, once again, I don't like the term right-wingers, I'm using their terminology for this, with guns is the problem, then the January 6th thing would have been a shootout. If conservatives are dangerous and violent, they would have showed up with their guns and they would have shot the place up. The place would have been lit up on fire. People would have been killed en masse. Meanwhile, you have a total of 5 Capitol officers that died, and none of them died at the site. All of them were for afterwards by means other than the event. They'll tell you, oh, 5 Capitol officers died. No, one had a stroke while a short time after. Another one had a heart attack. So there were some Capitol officers that died, but had nothing to do with January 6th. They're lying to you. Because that's what they do. They lie to you. I have a sister-in-law one time. I was talking to her, about 6 months ago, a little bit longer. And now it was longer than that ago, a couple of years ago, actually. Now I'm thinking about it. And she was all upset because my wife and I were visiting my in-laws without wearing masks. The whole family's all masked up and they're all freaking out. And so this must have been 2020, 21, something like that. Now I'm thinking about it. So it was a while ago. But anyway, and credit to my mother-in-law, she says, hey, you know, this is my house, not yours. If they don't want to wear a mask, it's okay. You got a mask on, you should be safe, right? But anyway, and so I get into a discussion with one of my sister-in-laws, and she says, oh, well, you're one of those Republicans, so you just want everybody to die. I'm like, you do realize that the masks do nothing. I mean, it's like trying to stop mosquitoes with a chain link fence. There's pores in your mask that make all of them are much larger than the virus. The mask doesn't stop virus. It stops droplets of water, like sweat and stuff like that. That's why these surgeons wear them is so that when they're sweating and stuff off their face, they're not dropping, drops of sweat into the open cavity of the person they're operating on. But they don't stop viruses. They don't stop bacteria. They don't even slow it down. They do absolutely, and if anything, they're actually more dangerous because now you're inhaling your own junk. Plus the rashes that you cause, there's all kinds of problems with the masks. They've admitted that the masks don't work, by the way, over the last year, but that's beside the point. But anyway, she started spewing about CNN this, and I said, you do realize, Laura, that CNN is lying to you. And she says, and I quote, they can't lie, they're national media, they're not allowed to. Really? Answered every question I ever had. That explained everything. And that's what we have. We have a society that listens to CNN and MSNBC and Bill Maher, that idiot, and a bunch of these other people. And it's like, I can't be too hard on Bill Maher because every once in a while he hits the mark correctly because he has half a brain. But for the most part, he's an idiot. But but the thing is, that's who they listen to. And they don't use critical thinking. They don't stop to think about this. Hey, this might be true, or this might be true, or that might. They don't even consider it. Oh, I was told this. They're lying to you. The media, politicians, and corporations, my whole life, I've known to lie to us. Everybody's known that. But suddenly, with COVID, they're all honest? All at once? Really? Of course not. So we have a broken system, and we have a gullible people that believe anything. And so we've got now a Donald Trump who bucks that system. He believes in the free market system. He believes in pulling back government in your life, getting rid of government regulation, and having a strong personality, be strong to keep the peace. No new wars started during Trump's presidency. The only president during my entire lifetime that did not start a new conflict. The only one, Trump. Does that mean he believed in being weak? No. He, in our existing situations when he became president, took quick, tough actions, and sent a message, and then left it. But see, the enemy feared him because of those quick actions rather than this long drawn out stupidity that we've got with Biden, with Ukraine and all this other stuff. And therefore, he kept the peace. But we have now a broken system because, see, we don't know what to do. We have cheating run amok. An election that doesn't operate the way it's supposed to. The Electoral College doesn't operate the way it originally was intended. And now they want to get rid of it. What little semblance of it exists. And we've got a Congress that's out of whack because we got rid of the state legislatures appointing the U.S. senators. We got rid of the county legislatures appointing the state senators, one per county. If it was one per county here in California, would the state senate look different? You darn tootin' it would. It'd be bright red. It'd be Republican dominated. And it wouldn't be these Republicans that have influence from the city voice, getting back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the show. It would be Republicans with a rural idea. A laissez-faire, leave me alone, let us do our own thing kind of attitude. That would be the perfect offset to the crazies in the House that represent the cities. And then right now, the House actually has a slim Republican margin. Normally it may or may not, depending on, but in a system that's done right, if it's not broken, it's going to operate the way it's supposed to, and the progressive left would be held at bay. They wouldn't have the power to control everything. Of course, they have power to control things, not just because of political. They've taken over the education, academia, taken over media, taken over the entertainment industry. What they've done to the music industry is disgusting. Taken over Hollywood. I mean, I've been saying all my life, everything is political. Politics is inserted in everything. Music, movies, television shows, commercials, everything. And I've had people tell me I'm full of it. But then once people start looking, they realize it's true. And they've got control of those mediums. We need to take control back. But we can't even control our Congress because the whole system is broken. So I guess that's the message today. We have a broken system. And the system needs to be fixed. How do you fix it? You go back to the U.S. Constitution. You go back to what was originally intended. You get rid of the 17th Amendment that changed the U.S. Senate. You reverse Reynolds v. Sims, which is a 1964 court case that forced the states to democratically, basically have their state senators democratically voted in and the districts be based on population rather than one per county. You get rid of those two things, you start to heal. You start to move this country back towards its constitutional foundation. You start to make America constitutional again. And lastly, let me wrap it up with this because we got about 3 and a half minutes left of the program here. We need to be a virtuous society. If we're not right with God, we're not going to get our political house in order if we don't get our faith house in order. We are not a virtuous society anymore. Our moral standard is not a standard. We have decided that what is right or wrong depends on what the person thinks. If you don't have a moral standard, then right, wrong is anything they want. And if that happens, society collapses because there is no right or wrong. How do you enforce law if there is no right and wrong? If there is no boy and girl? If there is no lifestyle that is not good for society and one that is? If you erase the lines and you have no standard and, you know, adultery and homosexuality and thievery eventually just becomes the norm. Now, that said, I don't believe that it is law that should enforce that. So, well, Doug, you have a problem with the homosexual, so you want to make law to stop? No, I don't. I believe in freedom. I believe in liberty. You want to have that behavior? Knock yourself out. Legally, there should not be a law saying you can't. But there shouldn't be a law trying to force everybody to accept it either. Let the culture take care of it. And if in the culture, I want to say, hey, I own a bakery and I am not going to bake a cake for homosexuals. I have that right. Well, I have a right to my cake. Yeah, and there's a guy down the street that'll make it for you. Go there. It is not government's place to force us to accept something, to shape our behavior and to mold our actions. It's not a government's business. That's the culture. Let the culture take care of it. It's like with the gay marriage thing. Well, you got to make sure the churches are willing to, you know, marry gays. No, churches are just like a free market. A church is going to reap the benefits or the consequences of their decisions by the size of their congregation. So if they decide they're willing to marry gay people and it's good or bad for their church, and so be it. If they decide not to, and it's good or bad for them, then that's their decision. Government's got no business to tell them how they run their church. Now, obviously, there is a line because there are certain laws. So if, you know, they're like doing human sacrifices, you're killing people, that's breaking law, then that's something different. We're talking just basic reason here. It's none of government's business. The laws are there, only necessary laws, to preserve and secure our rights and nothing more. But we have a government that believes it's a ruling class. It's there to dictate. And it's not. All right, so we are coming up on the final minute of the show. So I want to real quick send you to douglasvgibbs.com. Become a patron. Hit the join button or link, should I say, with a little star next to it up there in the link bar. $9 a month helps fund what we do. And we need as many patrons as we can. Also, this radio show exists because of you. It exists because of your dollars. We don't pay for the show if you don't donate. Simple as that. So go to paypal.com/paypalme/Douglas V. Gibbs. paypal.com/paypalme/Douglas V. Gibbs. Or you can Venmo me, Douglas Gibbs 3. That's Douglas with a hyphen, then Gibbs with a hyphen, and then 3. And then after asking for the four numbers, 3975. Or Zelle. You can Zelle me, DouglasVGibbs@yahoo.com. Otherwise, this show doesn't get funded. So, thank you for spending the time. United we stand. Combined we kick butt. God bless America, my friends. God bless you. Thank you for spending the time with me. Stay constitutional. And God bless. And don't forget to tell your friends about the show. It's also available on all the podcast platforms, Spotify and Audible and iHeartRadio, all of that. So, thank you for listening to the show. We'll see you next week right here on KPRZ, AM 1210, and all those podcast channels. God bless. We'll see you next time. And once again, stay constitutional. See you next time.